The roads leading to Quinton Fen were all empty. She thought she would leave the girl sitting propped against a signpost that pointed towards the sea bank. The kid would have to take her chances. Hypothermia might get her, or in her confused state she could wander off onto the marsh and fall into the river. Well, life was a gamble, wasn't it? She removed the straps, kissed the girl lightly on the cheek, and thanked her for a lovely time. Her mother had taught her good manners. She began to wonder about her mother, Gladys. She hadn't given her a thought in ages. Probably not since she had crept silently into that funny little annex at her aunt's house and doctored her medication. She arrived at the house, relieved that there was only a faint sliver of light at the horizon. Perhaps she would get the lad who did her garden to take the car to the breaker's yard. It was good to tie up loose ends. Her back ached from the night's exertions. She would run a hot bath. For once, there was no need to set the alarm. She would sleep as late as she liked. Chapter 26 D.I. Jill Mercer was locking her car. She looked as exhausted as Nicky.
"These damned women are driving me up the bloody wall,"
Jill said. "And a very good morning to you too, Jill," Nicky replied.
"Sorry, Nicky, but honestly, the blunt woman never went to any university that I've heard of. Zena Paris has several missing years, and Carla Hunt seems to have landed from another galaxy."
"And just to really make your morning, one of the Quinton victims, Delia Roberts, is buddies with all three of them."
"Bollocks! I think we need to talk, don't you?"
"As soon as my team are in, my time is all yours."
"I look forward to it. Until then, just call me Confused of Greenboro, okay?" "Mom, would you mind if I took a run out to see old Cyril Roberts? I'd like him to know that he was right about Gordon Hammond, and his old friend was innocent of everything the village accused him of," Cat said.
"Very noble, Cat, but slightly premature, I think. If he contacts us, you could let him know, but let's spend our precious time going after our killer, shall we?" Nicky smiled at her. "It can be your job once we get to it. Now, Ben, I want you to get out to all Delia Roberts' acquaintances. She is on our guest list at the Briar Patch last night, and I want to know who invited her. If she went to the club, then she may well have known Madeline Prospero or the Lawson family. She certainly never shared that when we interviewed her." "As I recall, she didn't share much at all, did she?"
"No, she didn't."
Nicky looked from Ben to Cat.
"Maybe you should go after all, Cat. Ask Cyril Roberts about his daughter.
Give him your good news, but tell him to keep quiet about it. He may feel more inclined to talk if he knows that his old mate really was innocent. I want to know when he saw Delia last. At your last interview with him, he said something about not what you know but who you know, referring to her posh job. So check that out, okay? And his wife, too. I need to know if she ever sees a daughter. I'd ask Cyril rather than her. He seems to know everything there is to know about her business."
"Righto, boss, I'm on my way."
Cat grabbed her bag and car keys and was gone. Ben left soon afterwards. Nicky and Joseph remained alone in the office.
"How long will forensics take, do you think?" he asked.
"The lab is rushing it through for me, but your guess is as good as mine."
Nicky's phone rang. It sounded shrill in the empty office. Rory's voice was muffled. She realized he was yawning.
"Two traces of midnight orchid, and I'm hoping your preliminary DNA results will be through in 24 hours. Fingerprints are running through as we speak. I can do no more at present, and I'm going home. Good day."
"Thank you, Rory. I really do owe you one."
"Oh, yes, you certainly do. Baggy eyes, indeed. Whatever next?"
Nicky relayed the news to Joseph.
"That's quick. I thought DNA testing took weeks."
"Rory said that they use a technique called PCR, where they chemically replicate tiny samples until there is enough to work on. Apparently it's really fast. He thinks that with the use of new computer software, it won't be too long before we get answers back in minutes rather than days." Joseph smiled.
"Criminals will have to wear sterile spacesuits.
Could slow up their getaway somewhat."
"On that note, what good old-fashioned CID work would you like me to do this morning?"
"First, find out how Constable Steve Royal is. Then check on the status of the victims that are under surveillance. I'll be with Jill Mercer if you need me."
Nicky cocked her head to one side.
"You're looking much brighter, my friend."
"I had a call from Tamsin last night. Laura turned up on the doorstep, and wasn't too impressed when they handed her a paint roller and a boiler suit."
A broad grin spread across Nicky's face.
"Very fetching."
Then she launched into a full-on gripe about me not returning her calls and received a lecture on the finer points of working a multiple murder investigation. From Niall? No, from Tamsin. The upshot was that Laura is considering moving back to Switzerland. It seems that her organization has decided it can't do without her after all, and quite a few olive branches are being proffered.
Oh, that is good news. Nikki put her arms round him, and for a moment they held each other close. Then, still smiling, Joseph gently held her at arm's length, looked at her and asked,
"Back to normal."
"Bring it on,"
sighed Nikki. "Let's go catch Avril Hammond, shall we?"
Cyril Roberts stood beside a crackling bonfire of dead wood and garden rubbish. Every now and then he would throw on another forkful of dry material and stand back as the sparks and flame shot into the air.
"Always keep a bit of dry stuff under cover. Then when it's going well, I can put the damp cuttings on."
Kat said nothing. The glowing embers and the smell of the fire transported her back to childhood bonfire nights.
"So I was right all along. You never done it. None of it. Not even once."
Cyril looked at her. The only thing he was guilty of was loving his daughter too much. He covered up her terrible cruelty when he should have found professional help for her.
"He was never the same since his boy got killed, miss. I expect he feared he'd lose her too. He just didn't deal with it right."
"He certainly didn't, Cyril. If she'd been helped as a small child, he'd probably still be alive, and all this death and pain may have been averted."
"Seems to me she was just born rotten. Nothing would have stopped that sort of evil from finding a way to manifest itself. And I think of what a lovely girl she seemed to be, and all the while."
Cyril took an old plastic sack of leaves and poured them onto the flames. The small dry leaves leapt into the air in a spiral of sparks, and the larger damp ones formed a smoky blanket over the hottest part of the fire.
"She used to come into the shop and help me, you know. Clean up and lay the meat out. She had more interest in the trade than my own daughter."
He looked at Kat again.
"And you think she might have hurt my Delia too?"
"We don't know for sure, but it seems that way. She, your Delia that is, doesn't say much."
"She did change. But I wasn't lying last time we spoke. I really believed it was like I told you. Perhaps I didn't want to see what was going on. If I'd known then what I know now, maybe things would be different. We're always wise in hindsight, miss."
"How long is it since you've seen your daughter, Cyril?"
"Must be 5 or 6 years, I suppose."
"Oh, Cyril, I'm so sorry. I thought she just called in as and when her work allowed, not that she didn't visit at all."
"It's the same for her mother. Whatever I think of her, she did love Ardelia, and the girl has no call to ignore her like she does."
"Does she phone?"
"No. I rang her workplace once. Her mother was none too special, had the shingles real bad, she did. Anyway, I thought the girl should know. She never even returned my call. Someone from a company rang her mother and asked if it was really urgent, and she told them to poke off. So, no, she doesn't phone."
"We went to her workplace to talk to her, but she was anxious to get back to an important meeting and didn't have time for us."
"How was she? Did she look well?"
"She looked very elegant. Very much the career woman."
"Well, who would have thought it? Do you know, at one time, miss, I hoped she would follow me into the butcher's trade. Roberts and daughter, master butchers. But no, as I said before, she had no interest. Then she found herself some new swanky friends, and they helped her get into some posh job. Word has it, she earns more in 1 week than I ever did in 6 months."
Cyril piled more rubbish onto the fire.
"Well, if that's the case, she won't need what I've put aside when I go."
"Do you know any of the people she took up with?"
"No, sorry. I'd kind of lost interest by then."
"Do you have a photograph of Delia? Or maybe of Avril, Cyril?" He smiled sadly and shook his head.
"I had a bonfire about a year ago."
Kat thanked him, turned to leave and then paused. "Cyril, would you like to see her again? Delia, I mean." He leaned on his fork and stared at a smouldering piece of wood that had rolled from the fire.
"At one time, not that long ago, I would have taken a meat cleaver to my own arm if it meant I could see her again. But now? No, I don't think so. Thanks very much."
"Let me get this straight. Zena told us she had an antique shop along the Fulham Road in London. Am I right?"
Jill was frowning. Yes, it was her shop, she said.
Well, it looks as if she may have worked in an antique shop there, but she certainly never owned one. She also said that she lived near World's End on the King's Road, but we can't trace her there at all. It was well seedy back then, not very salubrious at all. So where did the money come from to buy that upmarket emporium, Paris Antiques?
Should we pay her another call?
Two of my team are there now. I couldn't face her again.
I've taken on the mysterious Carla Hunt, Greenborough Businesswoman of the Year 2016, who has no past at all that I can discover.
Change of name?
No doubt, but I've never before come up against such a brick wall.
Then you've never interviewed Delia Roberts?
She's exactly the same.
I'm the mad Professor Blunt. I took a look at her diplomas.
Nicky grinned.
Really? I think I could arrest you for that.
Yeah, right, well, they're all fake. The first odd thing I noticed was that they were mounted in identical frames. Then I took a look at the photo of her in her academic gown, and it's been photoshopped. You know I did a spell in the fraud squad, right? Well, it stood out a mile. It was a skilled computer composition that cropped her face out of one picture and pasted it into another. I should think she knows as much about ancient history as I do about chicken sexing.
Which is?
Have you ever examined a chicken?
Jill pulled a face at Nicky.
Her phone rang.
Dear Melissa?
What?
Where?
We'll get someone down to the hospital right away, and thanks.
She slammed the receiver down.
Greenborough A&E. They have a young girl found wandering out near Quinton Fen early this morning. She's disorientated, pretty battered and bruised. The casualty consultant thinks we should attend, as he's certain she has been a victim of a sex attack. Oh, yes, and she's been given a powerful tranquilizer.
Date rape?
On a grand scale, by the sound of it. Come in with me.
No, I'll hold the fort here. Can you do me a favour, Jill? Check her right cheek for traces of Midnight Orchid lipstick, will you?
Nicky sat back in her chair, and the phone began to ring. Dave rang to say that Delia Roberts was not at work. She had taken 2 days' leave prior to going off to Holland for a business symposium. He had rung her home number, but only got an answer phone, so he was returning to the station. Kat phoned to say that Cyril and his ex-wife had not seen their daughter for 5 or more years, and finally Jill Mercer confirmed that there was a smudge of lipstick on the girl's cheek. It was a deep magenta colour. Joseph ticked another name on his list.
All seems well with Lucy Clark and Peter Lee. Delia Roberts hasn't been seen yet this morning. Her curtains are still drawn, and, as Dave says, she's on leave for a few days. She's probably having a lion. Our PC Steve Royal, on the other hand, is not faring so well.
Nicky looked up from the report she was reading. What's wrong?
They are pleased with his physical recovery, but apparently he is pretty down about his facial scarring, more so than the doctors think is healthy. I've spoken to his mother, and she says that his personal appearance is very important to him. He's having trouble coming to terms with the fact that, even after plastic surgery, he won't ever regain his looks.
Poor little sod. There's not much we can do on that score, is there?
Several of the WPCs have been visiting him, telling him scars make a man look really rugged and attractive. But he's having none of it. The hospital suggested counselling.
The mention of counselling made Nicky think of Sally King. It may help if Doc Foley talks to him. I'll ask him when he rings me about Sally's condition. She returned to her report, read the same line 3 times, and pushed it away. She picked up the list of guests at the Briar Patch auction. There they all were, as in Spooky's original list of members, plus about 10 other guests, none of them known to Nicky, other than Delia Roberts and Harriet the Rottweiler Page, Cena's lover. The office door opened, and Dave grumbled his way to his desk.
Waste of bloody time, that was. I should have rung ahead.
He took off his jacket and flopped into his chair. Before Nicky could ask him anything, Kat hurried into the room.
I've just seen D.I. Mercer's sergeant in the main corridor, ma'am. He said to tell you that they didn't have much luck with Zena Paris. Her manageress was off for a couple of days, and she was too busy to see them.
She flung her shoulder bag down on her desk and made for the coffee machine.
It's sad that Cyril hasn't seen his daughter for so long, isn't it?
Avril Hammond's wickedness seems to have touched the lives of almost all the inhabitants of Quinton O'Dyke, doesn't it? Past and present. She seems to have blighted everything she ever touched.
Joseph looked grave.
And she still is, whoever she is.
That's possibly the worst thing, isn't it? Nicky stared at the list of names. Everything tells us that we have her name right here in front of us. She's quite probably one of these women.
and any one of the others could be her next victim. We can't watch them all, and half of them aren't who they say they are. Frankly, unless we can get hold of a picture of her, we're pretty well snookered.
Nikki realized that her mobile was ringing.
Yes, Jill? What's the score with your girl?
The voice was tinny, the line full of static.
We're pretty sure she's another one of Avril's playthings, but I can't think why she's been allowed to live.
Nikki asked if the girl remembered anything.
No, it was a very nasty drug. The doctor in charge of her case said that it's comparatively new and its effects vary. The hallucinations can recur, a bit like having a fit, he said, and they have no idea what the long-term damage can be.
Through another patch of distortion, Jill said she would ring later when she found a better signal. Nikki vaguely understood that they were leaving a uniformed officer with the girl. Nikki ended the call. This case seemed to be dragging on forever. Chapter 27 It was 4 o'clock. A thin drizzle covered the town like a sheet. Nikki was staring out of a window when Richard Foley rang.
She's doing well, Nikki. Better than I ever hoped. It will take time, but Sally shows remarkable strength of character. I believe her love for her husband and children will get her through this,
Richard said.
Thank God one of them has survived the curse of Avril Hammond,
Nikki replied.
I've been thinking about her. In fact, having spent several hours with Sally today, I've thought about little else. I suggest you narrow down your search to a woman who, A, lives alone, B, whose job either gives her some kind of relief from her cravings or a considerable amount of flexibility, and C, who is known for being highly promiscuous, or manages to juggle several lovers. I believe she keeps her urge to kill at bay with unconventional and multifarious sexual encounters.
Thanks for that, Richard. I'll take another look at our list of suspects with all that in mind. Without a photo, we have no idea what she even looks like. Nikki remembered to ask if he would have a word with PC Royal. Nikki felt a strange, uncomfortable feeling in the pit of her stomach. Surely it wasn't a premonition. Then Yvonne burst in through the door.
I've got one! A picture of the young Avril!
Nikki jumped up.
I wondered where you'd gone. Show me!
She took the old photograph and stared at it. Disappointment flooded through her. The child was around 7, and like most of them at that age, something of a blank canvas.
Where did you find it? Doc Draper's wife. She kept scrapbooks of the village life back in the 70s and 80s. She'd been searching through them all morning. This was taken at a May Day procession.
Let's take it to our new computer room and see if Spooky and her gang are all they're cracked up to be, shall we?
Outside, the fine rain had turned into a steady downpour, and the sky was dark with heavy cloud. Nightfall would come early. She, Joseph, and the rest of the team waited while Spooky scanned the picture into her computer. Those few minutes were some of the longest of Nikki's life. The only sounds were the humming of the computers and Spooky's fingers tapping on the keyboard. A row of boxes appeared on the screen. The first held the original picture, cropped, enhanced, and showing just the child's face. Then the boxes showed the same face growing progressively older, until Spooky froze the last one and zoomed it out so that it filled the screen. They all peered at the image, hoping to see someone they recognized, but the face was that of a stranger. Spooky printed it off and grinned at their disappointed faces.
Hey, you guys, this is just the first try. I can alter things like weight, skin tone, and hair at the touch of a key. So shout if you see anything vaguely familiar, and I'll concentrate on that, okay?
The second attempt was no better. Nikki felt panic beginning to stir. This was their lifeline, hers and that of other potential victims. Spooky altered the variables and continued to produce possible likenesses from the basic bone structure. More weight, less weight. Hair long, hair short, black, blonde, red, crew cut, curly. Each slight alteration produced a singularly different-looking woman. Spooky was the first to make a connection.
There's something I recognize here. It's the mouth.
She reshaped the upper lip a fraction.
No, that's not it.
She went back, then tweaked it again.
Yes, that's more like it. Now, the forehead, and there's something about the eyebrows, too.
She sat back and stared at the monitor.
There is definitely something here. I just can't quite get to it.
Joseph moved closer.
This is someone I've seen recently.
He groaned.
But who?
Spooky smoothed and reshaped the face to fit slight changes in weight.
Spooky! Hold it there!
Yvonne's voice was excited.
It is the mouth! This is certainly someone we should know!
She held her hand over the screen so that only the chin and mouth could be seen.
Who the hell is it?
I haven't a clue, said Cat despondently. Nicky too felt a jolt of recognition.
You're right. But who is it?
Listen, I'm going to get the list of all 30-odd women. I'll call out the names and everyone try to put a face to them. Especially you, Spooky. You should know these women far better than any of us.
Seconds later, Nicky reappeared with the list and began to read out the names. She got to 21, and still there was no spark of recognition.
Celia Kennington, lawyer.
They shook their heads.
Harriet Page, Xena Paris's manager.
Well, I know for a fact that isn't her.
Sammy Cohen.
More shaking of heads.
Hang on, Nick.
Spooky bit her lip. Sorry, I mean, Diagolina.
I think I've got it. She's a Briar Patch woman, all right. Look, if I just give her shoulder-length red hair, styled like this...
She added the new feature.
And change the eye colour completely. Yes, it's Charlene Crawford. She works at Greenborough Hospital. The Path Lab or somewhere like that. God, yeah, it's Charlene.
But Kat and I interviewed her.
Ben's voice rose, and she had long, dark chestnut hair and glasses.
No, she doesn't. She's got medium-length red hair. I saw her just the other day.
Ben peered at the screen.
Yes, it's her face. Damn it, she must have been wearing a wig. And she does work in the Path Lab at the hospital. We saw her hospital security ID badge.
Close up? Did you check it thoroughly?
No, said Kat. She was fiddling with it all the time. I saw her name, but not her department.
Oh, she works there all right, Joseph added tautly, but not in the Path Lab. Can you give her short, cropped blonde hair, a bit like Kat's?
Spooky tapped the keyboard.
Nicky gasped.
Oh, my God. She doesn't work in the Path Lab at all. She's one of Rory Wilkins's two mortuary technicians, Spike and Charlie. Charlene is Charlie.
She exhaled.
Richard Forley said she'd have a job that would help her to relieve her cravings. Shit! She's been working in the morgue with her victims.
Oh, Lord. Including her own father.
Kat spoke in a whisper. Nicky thought of the last time she had called in at Rory's laboratory. Charlie had been standing gazing at the bleached bones of Gordon Hammond, her murdered father. She grabbed at the nearest phone and called the lab.
She's off duty for 2 days. Rory's office are phoning back with her address.
No need. She lives in a rambling old house on the corner of Viking Crescent and Foster Way.
Spooky shook her head in amazement,
and she told me her father left it to her in his will.
Well, we know that was a lie. Her poor father owned nothing.
Brilliant work, Spooky.
Okay, it's time to go. At last. I want everyone in the main murder room, on the double.
I'll get D.R. Mercer.
Dave ran from the room.
And I'll get Superintendent Whittle, said Joseph, and followed him out.
Can I do anything?
Spooky looked all set to don a stab-proof vest and join the police officers.
You've done enough for one day. Get home to Bliss and that pooch of yours. Once we've picked this woman up, we'll all be able to sleep at night. Or in your case, walk the sea bank again. And thanks for what you've done. You've been a diamond.
The windscreen wipers swished across the rain-splashed glass, and Nicky's heart pounded in time to their rhythmic thump, thump, thump. Viking Crescent was only a 5-minute drive from the station. In four, several police cars and vans screeched to a halt outside the tree-lined driveway. The house was dark, and as empty as it looked. It was now 6 o'clock, and Nicky had been right. The sky was already dark, with gathering night clouds.
What do we do? Seal it off and get the Sokos in, or back off and wait to see if she comes home?
Joseph looked at his boss.
Jill?
Nicky turned to her. What's your feeling on this?
Let's clear all the uniforms out of sight and leave a covert presence here. Then we'll put a watch on all the roads in.
She looked at Nicky.
I don't think she's coming back, but we can't risk it. Do you agree?
100%. Now, if she's not here and not at work, where is she?
Hunting down another victim?
Her swan song, maybe.
The thought made Nicky shudder.
Look, Jill, will you organise everything here? I want to get back to the station and get a team together to check out all her possible targets. I want to make sure the more vulnerable ones are safe.
Go ahead. I'll be back as soon as I'm through here.
Richard, sorry to bother you. We've identified Avril Hammond, but I need your help. I want to know who she might target if she only had one last opportunity to kill.
On the other end of the line, the psychologist took in a ragged breath.
Don't do this to me, Nicky.
You're my best hope, Richard.
Sod it, you're my only hope. I have to predict her next move or someone else will die.
Okay, but whatever I say, just remember she's a psychopathic killer, and normal logic doesn't apply.
Deal. So let's just say she conforms to type. Who is she after, Richard, for her final act?
From what Sally King tells me, and from your reports, she hates weakness in any form. She believed her original victims were weak, and that her father was a weak man. The youngsters she's abused recently have been the same, too easily manipulated. She thinks she's very clever. Well, she is. So if I had to guess, I'd say she'll choose a much stronger adversary this time. Someone that caused her problems, fought back. Someone who would not be sweet-talked with promises of sexual fulfillment. Someone quite like yourself, Nicky.
Me?
The thought horrified her. Or Sally. She has been fighting Avril Hammond every day of her life since she was 8 years old. Do you want me to arrange for some officers to come out to the clinic? Our security is good here, but as we are dealing with a real threat, a little extra help would not go amiss. Thank you. So, someone who has been a thorn in her side. Someone who may have had a part in her downfall.
Exactly.
But she could always surprise us. She might disappear and reinvent herself in another part of the country. Or choose some random person. Remember, Nicky, no rules.
Thanks, Richard, and I'll sort you out some protection.
Nicky arranged for backup to go to Richard Foley's clinic. She made a list of anyone Avril might believe was standing in her way. She stared at the names, and her blood turned to ice.
Joseph, everyone, I need your help.
She threw each of her team a note with a name and a telephone number scribbled on it. Ring them now. Tell them to lock their doors and windows and not go out for any reason, okay? Even if the caller says it's a matter of life and death, because that's just what it would be. Theirs. And if they hear from or see the woman they know is Charlene or Charlie Crawford, they must dial 999 at once.
She lifted her receiver to phone Spooky. She heard Joseph asking for Dr. John Draper, Dave requesting a word with Sammy, and Kat already talking to Zena Paris.
Spooky was not back yet. Not wishing to alarm Bliss, Nicky simply asked if she would get her partner to ring her on her mobile as soon as she came in. Dr. Draper and his wife were both at home and took Joseph's warning very seriously indeed. Zena Paris took a little more persuading, but finally promised to cancel her supper engagement and stay at home. She also said she would contact Harriet Page.
"Who's next, Mom?"
Kat held up the receiver.
"Dr. Sylvia Caulfield. Here's her number. And Kat, don't let her bully you. Tell her that she must not go out on any house calls tonight. Another GP will have to cover for her. Got it?"
"Yes, boss."
Kat began to dial. Joseph, Dave and Ben were all looking at her.
"Dave, will you ring Professor Anna Blunt? Joseph, do a very tactful call."
"No, we can't phone them with news like this. I want you to go to the Lawson house. You know where it is. This should be done in person, okay?"
"Quite right. How much do you want me to tell them?"
"Play it by ear, Joseph. There is no doubt in my mind that Charlene Crawford is the killer, and Maria Lawson probably knows that already. I'm sure that as soon as forensics get to her home and take something personal, the DNA and fingerprints from the crime scenes will tie up immediately. You can tell them whatever you feel appropriate."
Joseph left, and Nicky sat wondering who else should be contacted.
"Your so-called Professor Blunt has a guest staying tonight."
Dave ticked the name.
"No doubt she's safe at home, impressing some innocent woman with her bogus academic credentials. I don't think Kat is having much luck with Dr. Caulfield, though."
Kat covered the receiver with her hand.
"This is not good, Mom. She's already out on a call and her mobile is switched off."
Nicky's heart sank. "Does her surgery know where she has gone?"
"They said she had two calls, one from a patient and then a personal one, some friend in trouble. I've rung the patient, but Silver has been and gone, with no mention of her next destination. I'm getting back to the surgery now, but it's engaged."
"Hang up, Kat. Vonnie, Ben and I will go out to West Salterby. This really doesn't sound good. You stay here and organise a telephone check on calls to Dr. Caulfield's practice number. Find out from her receptionist what time she received those two calls, and take it from there. I want to know which friend is in so much trouble that Sylvia drops everything and dashes off into the night with her mobile switched off."
She grabbed her bag and coat.
"Christ, contact the butcher's daughter, Delia Roberts. Get word to her when you're free, okay? And ring your old friend Cyril, too. Avril might remember that the old boy was her father's best friend. Yvonne and Ben, come with me."
While they were running through the car park, Nicky heard her mobile. She grabbed it from her pocket and saw that it was Spooky. With a sigh of relief, she told Spooky what had happened.
"Don't worry, Nicky.
The boys across the road are bringing in a takeaway tonight, and we're well locked up. We'll even take the dog out in twos, I promise.
Nicky was about to end the call when Spooky said,
"What about Rosemary and Denise?"
Nicky swore. How could she forget to ring her own cousin?
"Ringing now, Spooky. Luckily, they don't rate too high on the at-risk register, do they?"
Spooky agreed.
"As far as I know, they have never had much to do with Charlene. I wasn't the only one who wasn't very comfortable around her."
Nicky tapped Denise's name as she climbed behind the wheel. Luckily, her cousin answered immediately. After she had assured Nicky that they were both at home and going nowhere, Nicky threw her phone to Ben and accelerated out of the station. She sped along the empty road to West Salterby. She had to reach Sylvia Caulfield. The more Nicky thought about that self-assured woman in her swirling skirts, the more certain she was that Sylvia was Avril's next target.
Chapter 28. A receptionist at the doctor's surgery had stayed to take calls, and one of Sylvia's partners was still there, waiting for news of his colleague.
"There's a couple of cars on their way, Dr. Tully. We believe that Dr. Caulfield is in grave danger. We have to locate her, and fast.
You're sure she said absolutely nothing to anyone before she left?" Nicky said.
The doctor ran a hand through thinning hair and tried to recall exactly what his partner had said.
"She said that she had to call on one of our long-term patients, a lad with MS, who had picked up a chest infection. Then she had to... what did she say? Oh, yes, she had to pour oil on troubled waters. A friend in trouble was all she said. She said nothing about having to travel to see this mysterious person, so I wondered if they were meeting at her home. Have you tried her place?"
"There was no answer on the phone, and a patrol car told us that her drive is empty. We are going out there as soon as we have more men to cover us."
"This is about the killer, isn't it?"
"Yes, Dr. Tully. We believe Sylvia is a target," Nicky said. He sank onto a chair and shook his head.
"Sylvia, of all people." "Well, Sylvia will give as good as she gets, Inspector."
"That's what I'm afraid of, Doctor, and she won't have the slightest idea of what she's up against."
Outside, a siren screamed through the night, followed by another, and then a third.
"Great," thought Nicky. "So much for the subtle approach."
She turned to Ben and Yvonne.
"Come on, grab a couple of uniformed units and let's check her home."
The rain had eased into a fine misty drizzle that seeped through clothing and chilled the skin. Sylvia's house looked dark and empty. Unannounced by sirens or blue lights and in absolute silence, policemen crept through the shrubbery. Greg Woodall appeared at Nicky's side.
"We'll go in on your word, Nicky. Jill has armed officers back and front. We're all ready to go."
"Right, sir. They know who they're dealing with, don't they? She has nothing left to lose. She likes knives, and we don't know how she'll react. She could give herself up, sit back and enjoy the media attention, or she may try to take out every officer who goes near her. Dr. Foley says that in a case like hers, there are no rules.
And, of course, she may not even be in there."
The super sounded as if he were trying to convince himself.
"I have a feeling she's there, sir, with Dr. Caulfield. We must do everything we can to keep her safe."
"If we are not too late." "At least she's easy to spot with her bright clothes."
His radio spluttered and crackled. He looked at Nicky.
"We are ready when you are."
She, Ben and Yvonne moved closer to their armed colleagues at the front line.
"Let's go."
Their search of the ground floor revealed nothing but empty rooms. Jill Mercer, Ben, Yvonne and Nicky, with three uniformed officers, gathered at the bottom of the stairs. At a nod from Nicky, they charged up, two at a time. The first two bedrooms were empty. They burst through the third door. The only light came from their torch beams. Nicky later saw that all the lamps had been smashed. The shafts of light illuminated two figures. One of them had a knife in her hand and stood frozen like an animal caught in a car's headlights. The other woman lay huddled at her feet, her skirts flashing a brilliant scarlet and emerald. She let out a cry of anguish and relief and tried to crawl away, all the time looking up in dread at the tall figure looming above her. It was all over in an instant. An armed officer dashed forward and dragged Sylvia to safety. Another officer threw a blanket around her and helped her from the darkened room. As she went, she called out to Nicky.
"She's mad! She..."
Ben Radley was screaming. "I said, put the knife down, now!" Nicky turned back to the room and heard a cry.
"Mom, come here!"
Ben's voice was full of horror.
Instantly, she knew that something had gone terribly wrong. She saw again the figure in the hall being helped down the stairs, and the fleeting glimpse beneath the swirling, colourful skirt of black trainers. Ben and Yvonne were still with the woman they had believed to be Avril Hammond.
"Get a proper light in there, for fuck's sake!" yelled Jill Mercer.
"And tell the others to keep hold of that first woman. I think she's our killer."
Nicky's voice was hoarse. Nicky ran to Ben's side and realized that Avril Hammond had faked a horrible tableau to confuse them. Sylvia Caulfield, dressed in her captor's clothes, stood like a statue, her ankles and legs bound tightly together and secured to the wooden frame of a heavy bed. One arm had been bent up from the elbow and taped tightly to her upper arm. The knife was tied firmly into her clenched fist, and Sylvia's lips had been taped shut. It hadn't been madness in those eyes. It had been utter terror. Nicky murmured some soothing words to Sylvia, assuring her that she was safe and they would soon get her freed. Then she pulled Ben away.
"Avril, we have to make sure they don't lose her."
She ran towards the stairs, calling back over her shoulder, "Jill, look after Sylvia, get an ambulance." Without waiting for an answer, Nicky, with Ben and Yvonne in hot pursuit, ran down the stairs, through the now empty hall, and out into the night. Outside, the garden was in chaos. No one knew what was happening. One minute the hostage was safe, then the hostage was not the hostage at all, and now someone had run away. Ben stood in the middle of the muddy lawn, trying to think. Something was prickling at the back of his mind, and then it came to him. "Mom, quickly!" Nicky and Yvonne ran towards the 4x4 where Ben was waiting. Nicky jammed her foot hard on the accelerator, while Ben explained.
"On the way to this lane, I saw an old hatchback parked beside a derelict farm building. I've just remembered. It wasn't there when we did that first drive-by."
The lane was dark and rutted, and Nicky narrowly avoided hitting the hatchback, throwing Ben and Yvonne forward. With its headlights off, it shot out from its hiding place, just in front of the Land Rover.
"Mom!" Yvonne pointed. "She's heading for the sea bank!"
Nicky turned, and the Land Rover's tyres bit into the muddy verge. The hatchback appeared to be making for the drove that led up to the marsh and the dead end of the sea bank. Ben kept his eyes on the brake lights.
"She's turned off. Charlene's taken the Fen Road to Quinton O'Dyke."
Soon they were on the single-track lane, out through the dark and dangerous fen. Ben radioed their position to the other squad cars in the area.
"This is one piss-poor route to take on a night like this. Lucky I know it," Nicky said. "At least she's had to put her headlights on. We can see where she's heading now."
They rounded a sharp bend and crossed a wide, water-filled ditch. Ben held on tightly to the armrest. The car rocked from side to side on a long bend.
"How long were you on traffic, Mom?"
Ben swallowed hard.
"Long enough to drive a damn sight better than her. She just overcooked a corner and almost ran out of road. If I can push her hard enough, she might just lose it. Does this lane go where I think it does, Yvonne?"
"Yes, it's the way back into Quinton Village. There's one or two really remote outlying homesteads, nothing else."
"So Avril's finally going home."
"What for?"
said Ben.
"Don't try to get into her head, Ben. It's too poisonous for the likes of you. She has her reasons. How far is Quinton, do you reckon?" 2 miles, maybe a bit less," said Yvonne.
Ben looked over his shoulder and saw pinpricks of light in the distance. More police cars were entering the fen. They continued along the treacherous lane at breakneck speed. Suddenly Ben sat forward.
"What on earth is that?"
From the black horizon over to their right came 2 shafts of light.
"Headlights. Could one of our cars be coming in from a different direction?" asked Nicky.
"No way, boss,"
Yvonne assured her.
"That's the very edge of the marsh out there. It has to be from one of the... Hang on. That's where Cyril Roberts lives. Right out on the far point of the fen."
"Well, if that's Cyril driving like that, we should offer him a bloody job. Look at those lights."
Ben squinted through the windscreen. The vehicle must have been travelling as fast as they were, on what was little more than a cattle track.
"Mom, he must be almost at the fen lane, but he's not slowing down," Yvonne said anxiously.
"It's a truck, a flat-back pickup, and you're right, he's not going to stop. Good God, look!"
Just ahead of them, the Toyota left the narrow track and ploughed full tilt up the grassy bank to the road they were on. With all the force of a goods train, it smashed into Avril Hammond's hatchback. Nicky brought the car to a halt. At the very moment, the 2 vehicles exploded into a giant ball of fire. Time stood still, and no one spoke. Then they leapt from the Ford and ran towards the twisted mass of burning metal. They could get nowhere near the blazing vehicles,
The intense heat came at them in waves, blown towards them by the breeze from the wash.
"Ben, over there on the bank!"
He found Cyril Roberts, lying in the long, soaking wet grass of the bank at the side of the lane. There was a crescent-shaped gash on his forehead, and his head seemed to be bent at an odd angle.
"Dead, ma'am,"
came through the windscreen by the look of it. "Neck's broken." Ben knelt down beside the body.
"Whatever were you trying to do, you crazy old coot?"
He felt Nicky's hand on his shoulder. "I think he knew exactly what he was trying to do, my friend. And a more spectacular job he made of it, too." The flames lit up the fen, and soon several police vehicles were drawing up at the scene. Nicky walked up to the top of the bank and watched the men and women talking excitedly on their radios or pointing to the entangled truck and car. So it was all over. Avril Hammond did not, in the final instance, leave this world on her own terms. Her father's best friend had avenged his death, and for once in her life, Avril could not manipulate or alter the course of events. And she hadn't gone out in a blaze of glory. Nicky smiled grimly. It had just been a blaze. Epilogue. St. Augustine's Church, Christmas. In the new part of the cemetery, two recent headstones glittered in the early morning frost. There were no mourners gathered around them, just some friends who had come to pay their respects. On one of the graves, Cat and Ben placed a wreath of fresh holly and pine, adorned only with a cluster of pine cones, a red ribbon, and a small card. It said that Cyril was held in affectionate remembrance. On the other was a single bunch of white lilies. They stood for a while, and then Cat looked up to the old church behind her. The winter sun had caught the facets of the great windows, which twinkled like a thousand crystal raindrops. The church looked as it should, a welcoming haven, a shelter from the storm and a safe place to be. She heard voices raised in quiet laughter. "And by next winter, we will have a completely new heating system. No more preaching to a congregation of Eskimos." Father Aidan stood with Joseph and Dave, his face alight with pleasure. Nicky appeared next to Cat.
"So your friend left all his money to St. Augustine's?"
Cat smiled.
"On the understanding that Father Aidan would give Cyril's old friend, Gordon Hammond, a proper funeral service and a proper grave, with a carved headstone and a marble surround. The rest could go to the restoration of the church. Nothing at all for his dear daughter, Delia."
"And she won't need it where she's going, will she? I wonder how long she'll get for perverting the course of justice." Nicky pushed the hair from her face, and her eyes flashed.
"I find it hard to believe that she knew about Avril, and what she got up to for so long. She was as bad as Avril in some ways."
Cat nodded, and rubbed her cold hands together.
"All to keep her top job and fantastic income. She was never afraid of her old friend. She faked her injuries and fooled her parents, but she was never a victim."
"No, and it seems that when Avril returned to Greenborough as Charlene Crawford, Delia told her friend that she could do as she pleased, as long as she left her alone. Other than Sally, Delia was probably the only person that Avril ever respected, if indeed she was capable of respect. She certainly admired strength, be it for good or for evil, so Delia was never really in danger. I don't think she was ever an actual accomplice, but she was callous enough to accept the awful things that Avril did." They stood in thought for a moment. Then Nicky said,
"I can't help wondering what would have happened if you had contacted Cyril earlier and warned him to lock himself in until we caught her."
"Me too, Mum. I only got hold of him after you and Ben took off across the fens like bats out of hell. I was frightened that she was going to hurt Cyril, so I told him exactly what I'd just heard on my radio. I had no idea he would turn the tables on her." Nicky watched a robin land on the Hammond headstone, tilt its head to one side and stare intently at them.
"Some say that robins are messengers from souls that have passed over."
Cat looked at the bird and smiled.
"Well, perhaps he'd be kind enough to tell Gordon that he can finally rest in peace."
The tiny bird burst into song, and then, with the final few notes lingering in the morning air, it spread its wings and flew away. This concludes Buried on the Fens by Joy Ellis, narrated by Henrietta Meir. Copyright 2017 by Joy Ellis. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Joffe Books, care of Lorella Belli Literary Agency, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information
on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.